Welcome back to the program. Certainly the world is shrinking. As a result, every day in both our personal lives and our professional lives, we are forced to deal with people that are different than ourselves and perhaps different than what we are used to. And yet, to a very real extent, we still tend to take refuge in sameness. The us versus them mentality, which is so much a part of our culture, is still powerfully pervasive. How do we move beyond this? How do we reset our approach to the world so that diversity and difference becomes not only a driver of innovation, but a way that brings us pleasure and the joy of difference? We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Todd Patinsky. He's an associate professor at the State University of New York, Stony Brook. Prior to that, he was an associate professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School and a research director of Harvard's Center for Public Leadership. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Todd Patinsky here to talk about us plus them, tapping the positive power of difference. Todd Patinsky, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Jeff, and hello to your listeners.
Good to have you here. One of the fundamental ideas that you talk about is this notion that we have always viewed difference and diversity as something that we have to learn to tolerate as opposed to something that we could better embrace. Talk about that.
Well, I think we're off to a great start because you used the right word. We've always viewed it, but the book shows that while we've always viewed it as something, we have not always experienced it as a negative. And so in your lead-in, your gracious introduction, you said, how do we get beyond being forced to deal with it? And I would just put out there, is that really true? If we think about the kinds of ways we spend vacations, very often many of us strap on a backpack and try to go to another country. Many of us may find a coworker mentions a religious holiday we may know very little about, and we actually ask questions about it. We don't run to get an office chair to use as a weapon against. So for what we find is a majority of folks, they have a healthy curiosity, interest, and enthusiasm. It's just our leaders and our policies have really come to assume an original sin of sort of spring-loaded bigots that are wired. And the book walks the reader through how these pervasive assumptions became such and also the damage that it does.
Because there are a couple of competing pervasive ideas out there. One is this notion that much new research has shown that we have this, as you say, this curiosity, this desire for that which is new and different and to better understand that. And yet this public meme that has been out there for so long that somehow we only want to be with people like ourselves.
Oh, absolutely. And it's funny. You often hear the word that we're often tribal in our nature. But if someone reflects on what it means to be tribal, from the most tribal, even the most strictly tribal communities, they trade with other tribes. They intermarry with other tribes. So even the metaphors that are seen as reinforcing sort of a retreatist impulse actually shows that, yes, there is a retreatist. And nothing in the book is to say that there is not cases in which people are negatively oriented towards difference, but that more often when we see conflict in the world, difference becomes what people lay the blame at, but it's often an economic or a political difference, and that we do ourselves a real disservice both to human nature and also to human potential, the kinds of communities we can create, when we too quickly assume that us and them equals us versus them.
What about the larger argument that we hear that it is the upheaval in the world today, the newness, the stress, all the things that we face as a result of technology and the shrinking globe, that in fact those things are pushing us more towards a tribalistic attitude?
Well, we certainly have large-scale changes in the world. And so the question becomes, how do people respond to those? But the large-scale changes are not simply about difference. It's not simply that we're learning about other different people. It's changing our economy. It's changing our communities. It's changing the kinds of work, the kinds of education people need. So even in the most profound changes, the real question is it difference that's driving any negative response, or are the other things that leaders really should be focusing on? And too quickly, we assume that it's human nature. And if I could, I'd love to give some examples.
Please.
Yeah, so let me just give you an example from one which some of your listeners may actually remember. It was a Newsweek cover story is your baby racist? And it had an adorable baby on the cover story, and it sold an awful lot of magazines for Newsweek. So being interested in what we see in the world, and we do research. So we do surveys, we do experiments, we do interviews. What we found was something quite different. And so I read the article, you know, from first sentence to last, and I found in an article in a hefty, you know, news source, Is Your Baby Racist?, there were only eight studies that were referenced, and Jeff, only one of those was a study of infants or babies. And that one study found that infants or babies stare longer at folks who are a different ethnicity than their primary caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes the evidentiary evidence that babies are racist. But if you look at our communities, we tend to track hate crimes, and the media does a good job of paying attention to them. But if folks just look at the communities around them, they're more characterized by helping acts than hate crimes.
Because in many ways, us versus them stories are more inherently dramatic, and they're the ones that are going to get told.
They're more inherently dramatic, but if I could show how it can become really dysfunctional, one just needs to look at corporate America and its lack of traction around anything meaningful in diversity, you know, and the often challenges people have sitting through diversity trainings. And for that matter, the book shows how schools can be very well-intentioned but very misguided. So, for example, I had visited one of my nephews at a middle school, and on my way to his classroom, I had observed over 100 pledges that the kids had been asked to pen and sign. And they were beautiful. You know, the kids had done it meticulously with wonderful drawings and illustrations. And so I went up and I wanted to go closer. And the pledge that they had asked these young people, it was a diverse school district. There had been no hate crime. There had been no incident. I can speak to my nephew's friendship circle. It was diverse. And they had asked the kids, from this day forward, I pledge not to hate others who are different. I pledge not to be bigoted in my thinking. It was all about both avoiding negative and also assuming that these kids came tainted with some original sin. So it really creates a house of mirrors, and we see the same thing in corporate diversity, where we sort of pay attention to a very thin slice, and it distracts us from what we really need or want, which is to identify when the positive emerges and really how to promote it.
Talk about that corporate diversity training, because in many ways it's the opposite of what you're talking about. It's really based on an inherently negative model.
Yeah, and it's too often unscientific, and it's really surprising because, you know, business needs innovation, and there are lots of reasons to expect that a diverse workforce really could help us become a more innovative workforce. But the problem with the corporate mentality, and I'll speak to the training as well, it's a bit like assembling the ingredients. So the metaphor I sometimes use is if I want bread, which I love to eat, if I simply assemble the ingredients on my counter and then expect the bread to sort of naturally emerge, that's never going to happen. You know, there has to be an intentionality around it. It has to be combined properly. It has to be in certain conditions. So this notion that diversity equals innovation is a really naive one. But often those who are promoting that very view send very mixed messages. And so I do some work in this area. And before I did, I really wanted to sit through a bunch of trainings and try and understand the state of the science. And the first training I sat through, very early on, the presenter hit with the message, diversity is our strength, diversity is our strength. And within two slides, Jeff, he had transitioned to, we are all the same. So you can imagine the folks in the room hearing that diversity is our strength, but we are all the same. If you come away confused and if you come lukewarm, it may be no wonder. And so the focus of my work is, you know, under what conditions do we see the positive, and how can corporate cultures really create? Because, again, if we simply have diverse workforces, that's just simply a description of them. The question is whether they're going to be diverse and catalytic for innovation.
What are the examples that you've seen where they have been both, where the diversity has, in fact, had a very positive outcome?
Well, you see it. I mean, one of the examples I'm interested in is mentoring, because it's so important to helping folks navigate their own careers. But also it's important, you know, from the corporation's sense for leadership succession, right? to not just have a whole bunch of leaders one day retire. And we also see this in government agencies, by the way. It's not just the government. And what I've been struck by and what we've been studying is the nature of very strong mentoring relationships across ethnic groups. We sort of very often corporations recognize that folks from underrepresented groups really need mentors as much, if not possibly more, than other folks. But they also, they tend to look to the one or two senior placed folks who come from these groups to be their mentors. And what we find in our work is that if you identify the right folks who may not share the demographic characteristics, it can actually lead to stronger outcomes than with in-group mentoring.
As we look at the larger picture of globalization and we see a kind of cultural homogenization that is taking place in so many places, talk a little bit about the impact of that on this larger framework.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because clearly the media is, the world is changing, and largely it's driven by sort of new technologies and new social medias. And so there are two main thrusts of the book in which we really try and understand this. First is generational, right? Because in our work, we originally did work on folks as young as 7 and as old as 92. So we find that this positive impulse is not restricted just to the younger, but certainly younger folks have a different orientation and attitude, and it's not what's typically ascribed to them, which is typically it's often said that young folks today grow up in a world in which race is invisible or there is no construct of ethnicity, and that's not true. And I'm surrounded by them every day. They're interested in a global world, but a world of positive difference. They're extremely interested in music that may be different than their own. They're extremely interested in culture that may be different from their own. And so young folks today are not drawn to the homogenization. They're drawn to what's unique or different, and they're positively drawn to it.
Are we seeing specific generational change, and what do we know about those younger generations as they begin to age?
It's a great question, and it's a sophisticated one, right? So will these young folks, as they get older and have mortgages and children and a whole host of other responsibilities, is there something about sort of life course events that will have them look more like the other? The evidence seems to suggest, and again, we don't have good data that speaks directly to this because we'd have to follow this cohort, but their level of positivity at early ages seems quite different than just a generation ago. So they're starting off in a different place. So their courses will be quite unique and quite distinct. And really the question becomes, how much are they able to steward the world? One of the challenges that we take up in the book is to show how can leaders move beyond what we've seen for generations of leading by dividing. So Democrats saying we're not Republicans, Republicans saying we're not Democrats, political leaders, ethnic leaders, they really have a too easy fallback on leading by pitting us versus them. And so the question becomes, will this next generation not only themselves feel the positive power of difference, but also be more adept at assuming leadership positions and a different kind of leadership and a bolder kind of leadership?
Which begs the question whether or not it's even possible to change or to really effectively change the current generation of leadership, or do we simply have to wait until this younger generation takes their rightful leadership place?
It can change. It can change largely because, there's context to all this. And so in the book, we take up, a lot of forms of difference. We look at ethnic difference, religious difference, but we also look at political difference. And certainly in 2013, folks are pulling out their hair over what's happening in Washington. And we show that this is not something that can't be changed. There are actual small, tangible changes that would make a big difference for us to move us versus them to more productive relationships.
Of course, pushing back against that, and you talk about this, is basically a whole industry that is based on the idea of dividing people and of creating more hate, essentially.
More hate, and then also just simply understanding hate. And so I'll give you an example. I mean, there's a there's a journal, there's an actual magazine of hate studies. There are conferences I can go to hate studies, and there is nothing. We found over 400 words to describe isms and phobias and all the whole negative spectrum. We found zero to describe the positive. And what this does, and what we show, is it creates a real house of mirrors where people start to question what is normative, what is appropriate. And so we're feeding back to ourselves not only a distorted reality, because this is not human nature. This is not how most people experience difference. It's destructive. And in the book we show we really have to reclaim the sort of more natural and nurturable orientation towards difference.
Right. I mean, going back to this idea that empathy is somehow going to be the solution to everything.
We love empathy in 2013. it's really, I mean, if you look at schools, if you look at that corporate diversity training we were talking about before, what we show, though, is that even that has become tainted, because clearly being able to adopt someone else's perspective is extremely important. But what we've done is really tap a very small potential for empathy, which is we've really engaged in empathic sorrow, and that's not going to... We've become enamored with getting people to feel pity or sympathy or sorrow for others. And we've actually studied empathic sorrow, or what many people call sympathy. And what we found is that sympathy does reduce the incident of negative. So you're unlikely to go to war with someone if you feel great pity or sorrow. But, if you want to predict the proactive engagement across difference, so if you want to predict diverse communities working well, if you want to predict that cross-group mentoring I was referencing earlier, anything proactive and positive, it's not empathic sorrow, it's actually empathic joy that is the better predictor of that. And we show in the book how we really need to transition from an addiction to getting people to feel pity or sympathy to really creating spaces where people can feel joyful and happy about not just their own group pride and their own group memberships, but also other groups that together comprise this global village.
And how much of that, in the larger context, is about understanding other people's life circumstances?
Oh, absolutely. When you have an opportunity, and very often people share this, that there was some direct experience that they had from someone with another group, but what we miss, and we miss it profoundly when we go to run programs in schools or programs in corporations or to teach folks about it, is that when you have an experience like that with someone from a different group and it opens you up, it's opening you up not just because you feel pity or sympathy or sorrow, but you feel joyful. It happens in the context of a friendship. It happens in the context of getting to know a new neighbor, you know, who may have moved into your neighborhood or anything like that. So in these close personal relationships, which, Jeff, absolutely very often are what becomes a conduit or a potential lever for change, the change happens not just because we have pity or sorrow, but because we're having a rich relationship with someone. So we're learning not just about their challenges, but also about their joys.
And to what extent is technology and social networking playing any kind of a role in all of this as you see it?
It is so rich in potential, and the potential is so underutilized. Now, your program will air, I believe, on the West Coast, where a lot of this technology comes from. I'm on the East Coast, and in the book we talk about something called the Facebook fallacy. So social networking technology is so great in potential, but too many people sort of believe that new technology will lead us to some kind of positive, desirable state that's somehow inherent in the technology itself. It's the leaders who must do the leading, and we need technologies that are not just developed overwhelmingly organized to prioritize profit and transform society second, but really are held accountable for in what ways are they transforming society. So technology is wonderful in its potential, and we tackle it in the book, but we also show the specific kinds of technologies that could deal with not just an agnostic kind of let's collect the most eyeballs we can, but really with an eye for how can we create the richest communities that we can.
And beyond the business productivity aspect, how else can we measure this? What kind of metrics can we lay out to see this positive change happening?
Well, we'd expect it in our communities. So in our work, some of the things we do when we go to schools and when we go to corporations is we do a network analysis, and we look at not just who sits next to each other in a corporation or in a school or who's in a classroom, but we look at friendship networks. So who's spending time together, who's positively engaged with others. So you would expect it, so a nice corollary perhaps might be, you wouldn't pick it up in the number of hate crimes that are happening in a community. You'd pick it up in the helping acts. And the way that we look at that is we look at folks' close personal networks and the extent to which they're engaging in positive behavior. But we also look at very tangible things. So one of our projects was actually working with an us versus them in a corporation where there was a lot of dysfunctional silos, right? Marketing didn't get finance, finance didn't get marketing, everybody hated sales. And so you can see it in the nature of relationships, not just in small communities, but across the larger community, or in this case, the broader organization.
And you've come up with this idea of allophilia as a sort of general overview of how to define all this.
Yes, and I'm smiling because the name may be new to folks, but they don't have to worry about catching it. It's we didn't so much as come up with it as stumble against it. You know, we kept finding that measures of hate didn't do a really good job of predicting the kinds of things that people, that leaders were interested in, or that most of us want in our community. And so we realized that we were going to have to come up with a measure, and we developed the allophilia scale. But we also, we realized we needed a word. I mean, I was giving talks where I was standing up and I was saying, the kinds of positive orientations and interest and enthusiasm that we all know we bring towards difference very often, and you can imagine that's a very clunky way to give a talk. So we didn't have a racism. The closest we had was tolerance. And as many of your listeners may be thinking, our research and the work we do in the world is not about tolerating others. So we spoke to the reference librarians at Harvard, thinking there must be a word out there, and they're very skilled at ferreting out lots of bits of trivia, and they couldn't find one. So we simply said, you know what, we're going to go back to the Greek, and we took allo for other and philia for liking or a positive orientation, put them together, allophilia, and that's how we refer to it, and that's actually how we developed our scale to measure it in the world.
And where do you see your research going? What are the points that you're still trying to ferret out from all of this?
Oh, goodness. There's the book in many ways is really just an introduction, because we've shown that it really is sort of a second dimension of us and them relations, and one that's so poorly understood. One thing that that the book begins to dissect but doesn't fully enough in our research is a relationship which has perplexed many, or a hypothesized relationship between how we feel about our own groups, right? Our own identities are extremely important to us, and the book and our research recognizes that. And we observed a paradox, actually, that some of the folks who feel most attached to their own religion and their own ethnicity and their own nationality actually are the most positive towards others. And so understanding that is really intriguing to us, right? Because then you get the best of both worlds. You get the rich community, the rich identification, and you also get the rich engagement with others. So understanding those folks in a really deep way and what makes them tick is really exciting to us.
Todd Patinsky, his book is Us Plus Them, Tapping the Positive Power of Difference. Todd, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, Jeff, thanks to you, and thanks to your listeners for thinking about these ideas.
Thank you.